This is an interview with Richard Kennedy for the Youngstown University Lisbon Remembrances World War II segments by Gene Krucke at Lisbon, Ohio, the Kennedy Home, on July the 18th at approximately 8:30 p.m. Okay, Mr. Kennedy, will you tell me something about your family background?
Yes, I was born in Alliance, Ohio in 1921. My father came from Latonia, Ohio. My mother came from North Georgetown, Ohio. My father joined the Pennsylvania Railroad in Latonia when he was 16 years old. Lied about his age. Joined the railroad when he was 16, and he moved to Alliance. Met my mother, who incidentally, my father went to the third grade of school. My mother was a college graduate, having graduated from Mount Union College in 1903. She taught my father everything. I went to Alliance High School, graduated from Alliance High School in January of 1940. During those years, we had mid-year and two graduations a year. I then went to Capital University in 1941 and was there for 3 years. 1943, I was drafted. And during the summer months that I went to Capital, when I would get back to Alliance, of course the war was on, and I worked in a factory in which they made tank treads for tanks. I worked 3 summers to help pay my way through college. My deferment from college ended in September 1943. I had 3 years of college.
Now, why would they do that? Why would they let you get so near the end?
Well, because they were getting close to D-Day, and I think they were building up the forces.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And that's exactly what happened. All the college deferments, most of them ended about that time. As I say, Capital University was a Lutheran college. We had a lot of seminary students. Their deferment stuck, but most of the others we were on deferment ended. So I went into the service in October of 1943. I went to Fort Hays, Columbus. And in Fort Hays, Columbus, they would assign you to units. They assigned me to Fort Riley, Kansas, to the horse cavalry. Now, I had never been on a horse in my life. Here I had 3 years of college. I was working on a Bachelor of Science in Business Administration. But they assigned me to a horse cavalry. I went out to Fort Riley, Kansas in the fall of 1943 for basic training. Basic training in the horse cavalry was one of the toughest basic trainings in the Army. Our cadre, that is those who trained us how to ride horses, how to shoot from horses, were all from Arizona, Montana, and Colorado. And they were excellent horsemen. And they couldn't very well get over the fact that some guy from the middle west of the city came and was going to learn to ride a horse. I had a very difficult time, I'll admit, with the basic training. But, and it was so cold out in Fort Riley, Kansas. I got there in the winter of 1942. It was so cold that we would go out on maneuvers and bivouac, and it got so cold they took the horses in because all the water froze. They couldn't keep any water. The horses had to go back into their stalls in the city of Fort Riley, and they left us out, which was a very uncomfortable.
What did they intend to do with you after they had you trained?
Well, okay, at that time, there were several troops of horse cavalry. And they were stationed in the Philippines. Some of them, most of them were stationed in California, but they had some in the Philippines. And they had planned initially to use them maybe in Burma, China, somewhere along there. The cavalry is a reconnaissance part of the army. They go ahead. So these horsemen would go ahead and scout. They could spread out. And that was their job. And incidentally, even in modern warfare, they still have the cavalry, only the armored. They had, during World War II, the highest casualty rate in service because they would send them out ahead and they would often get, get them from behind. Well, what happened was, after I finished my basic training, we were all assigned a horse. We had our riding outfits. They sent us out to Fort Ord, California. They issued us summer uniforms, and we were headed for the Pacific. Where in the Pacific, we did not know. At that time, of course, the Philippine Islands were under control of the Japanese. So we thought we were either going to New Zealand or Australia. But that was in February of 1944 when we arrived in Fort Ord, California. Of course, D-Day was June 6th, and all of a sudden, all the orders were changed. Our horses were taken away, and we were dismounted, and we were sent back to Fort Campbell, Kentucky, and put in an armored cavalry outfit. That was the last horse cavalry troop, I think, that the United States Army had. We had in that troop, I would say, roughly 1,500 men and horses. We learned to shoot from a horse riding. We learned to shoot a 45. We lived with them. Mm-hmm. I've never been on a horse since.
Is that right?
Okay.
Do you still remember the name of the horse that you were assigned?
Al. So anyway, I was then in the armored cavalry. And the armored cavalry in that troop was in the 33rd troop. Consisted of two jeeps, two lead jeeps, an M8 tank, and two 6x6s. Well, anyway, I took my training in the armored cavalry at Fort Campbell, Kentucky. On May 30th, 1944, now bear in mind, D-Day is June the 6th.
Mm-hmm.
May 30th, 1944, we were sent to New York City. We departed New York City on a troop trip headed for Europe. On June 6th, we were just arriving in English waters. outside the British Isles, and they turned on the radio and the ship had 8,000 soldiers on the ship. Eisenhower came on and said, "The troops have just landed and the invasion is on." Well, we thought for sure we were going in right away. Fortunately, we didn't. We landed in Liverpool, England on D-Day. And they were just bringing back the remnants of the 82nd Airborne Division, who had parachuted into Normandy. And they were a ragtag outfit. They really got beat up. And as we were going off the ship, they lined up down there, and all they could say was, "You'll be sorry." But anyway, so we stayed in Liverpool, England, and during the time we were in England, of course, was the time that they were sending over those buzz bombs, E-1 rockets. And we were scared to death of those bombs because they were really rough. Then I was sent to what is called Swindon, England, an American school center. And for some reason, I guess because I had some college, they put me in a secretarial school and I learned to type.
It's a long way from the horse cavalry to the typewriter, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah. I was there about, that was about June, last part of June. And then one night, took us out of our barracks, about 2,000 of us, and put us on a ship and put us in a replacement depot, and the next morning we were headed for Omaha Beach. Now we landed on Omaha Beach on August 21st. Now June 6th, July, August, that was 2 months after D-Day. We did at that time go over the side of the ship. They didn't have any docks over there yet. We crawled down the side of the ship on rope ladders with a full pack, and we headed inland. And we headed into a big replacement depot outside of Cherbourg. And at that point, we joined the 14th Armored Division. And since I was then back being a cavalry, I was put in a reconnaissance outfit of the 14th Armored Division. The 14th Armored Division was with the 1st Armored, and we headed towards Paris. We went through St. Lo, utterly destroyed St. Lo, at a place called Caen, C-A-E-N, all on the road to Paris. We got to Fontainebleau, which is on the outside of the suburbs of Paris. And we're bivouacked outside. I remember looking up at the sky and there was dogfights going on up there. The first sergeant comes along and you get up, get your gear together, you're moving out. Well, what had happened? The Allies had just taken Paris, which was about 15 miles from Fontainebleau. And they were moving SHAPE, Supreme Headquarters Allied Expeditionary Forces, from London to Paris.
Okay.
On August 21st, Paris fell. On August 23rd, I, with about 50 other guys, entered Paris, and from laying on the ground, and incidentally got a battle star for Normandy, but from laying on the ground, that next night, they loaded up us in the trucks, took us into Paris, and there wasn't a civilian vehicle in Paris. All you saw was army vehicles. They put us in a hotel with sheets on the bed. And I remember so well, they took us down to the dining room of this hotel. And the French waitress or something came out on the table and put bread on the table. We hadn't seen bread, and everybody grabbed that bread, and the whole the bread was gone about 5 minutes. Well, what I didn't know was that I was being, because again, I had 3 years of college. I was assigned to Public Relations Division of SHAPE, Supreme Headquarters, Allied Expedition Headquarters. That was Eisenhower's headquarters. Mm-hmm. I spent the rest of the war with Eisenhower at headquarters. As a matter of fact, I remember riding home to Anne at her home in Lyons. And they had just got a little dog and had named it that. So they named it Ike after Eisenhower. But anyway.
Did you ever guess then or have any inkling that he'd be President of the United States?
No. No. None at all. Of course, politics at that time was far from our mind.
Yeah.
Our job.
Probably his too, for that matter.
Yeah. Our job was taking war correspondents and VIP, very important people, congressmen, senators, and so forth, and war correspondents to the front lines, and providing them with shelter, sustenance, and the ability to send their stories back to the United States. This was a pretty big job in wartime. Some of the correspondents that I can remember by name, and I'm sure that lot of others, but I don't. Ernie Pyle, Walter Cronkite, Eric Severide, Margaret Burke White, and many others that I just don't.
Well, I think you've hit the big four. You've
yeah.
hit the biggies.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and one interesting thing about Ernie Pyle, he would come up to our office and talk to him. 2 years ago, we were in Hawaii, and I was in Honolulu, and she was in the hotel, wanted to do something else, and I said, I'm going out to, have you ever been to Hawaii?
No.
I said, I'm going out to Big National Cemetery out in Honolulu. And I went out there, and it's a beautiful cemetery. And as you have to walk up a big hill before you get up to where it is. And as I got halfway in the cemetery, I was tired of walking, and they had a bench there. And I sat down to rest, and I looked down to my left, and here's a tombstone, and on it it says Ernie Pyle. Of course, I knew that Ernie Pyle was killed in the Pacific and buried in. There was his.
It's kind of an eerie feeling after you'd known him, huh?
Yeah. Oh, that was. That was kind of a shock.
What did you think? Which of the correspondents did you like best? As a person.
Well, I think Eric Severide, of course. Now he spent most of his time in England, particularly before the invasion, and then he came over. Paris was a big communication center, of course. And Eric Severide, of course, I really didn't get to know Walter Cronkite very well. Thought he would have been better. And some of the women were, there weren't too many, but Margaret, I remember Margaret Burke White, I guess, because of that triple name. I don't know whether she's still living or not.
I don't either.
But then, of course, the VIPs would come, and because we had access to the transportation and the facilities, we took care of them. You know, like congressmen and senators.
Anybody who stands out in your mind?
Well, Eleanor Roosevelt was one that came over. Now that, of course, was after the war. She came over. And, of course, we were still in operation, and we were still, you know, And we took her on a tour of the front row of fighting in there. Of course, I remember Churchill quite well. Churchill came over a lot. He'd come to our office. Well, of course, the building we were in housed Shays, the headquarters. So all the bigwigs come and went.
What building did they take over?
In Paris? Mm-hmm. Well, one was right across from the opera. Was the... We were in Paris, see. Another of the big offices was in Versailles. That's where a lot of them were. Between Paris and Versailles, which wasn't too far. I'm trying to think of the name of that building.
You've been back. Is it still standing?
Yes, it's still standing. In fact, when I left a bicycle down in the basement. I went down there, looked, but it wasn't there. Then we moved Shape forward, went up to, what was the name of that building in Paris where my office was in?
I.D. Barman Building.
No, that was in Frankfurt. Across from the Opera, where I left the bicycle. American Express Building, a great big name. But anyway, after the Allies went into Germany, and we got to Frankfurt, Germany, they moved Shade from Paris to Frankfurt, Germany. The I.G. Farben Building was one of the largest complexes in Europe, and it was Germany's big armament, I.G. Farben. It was, everything else in Frankfurt was bombed out, the Bahnhof, and everything. Except the IG Farben building. And the rumor was that we got, that the Allies did not bomb because we wanted it for headquarters. And that's exactly
what we
did.
And we were that precise with our bombing?
Hmm?
Were we that precise with the bombing that we could have left
Apparently
that standing?
So. They
Isn't
left
that something?
It. And so we had our big offices in the IG Farben building, Frankfurt, Germany. And then we lived in Wiesbaden, which is about 20, 30 miles from Frankfurt. And we had an office there, too, in a park hotel. The only thing I was put up in a hotel.
Tell them about your transportation, you and the other two friends, Richard.
Mm-hmm.
Tell them how you got around.
In bicycles, there.
Oh, he was just saying, and he left the bicycle in the basement of the building and went back later to check and it was gone.
No, it was in Paris, of course, that we met the French friends. Both Mary and Karen went over and stayed with them, and their kids came over here and stayed with us after the war. Okay, now...
The French people were that happy to see the Americans, weren't they?
Yes, they were very happy. So after the war was over, of course, and I was in Paris, VE Day, and you see those pictures out on the Champs-Élysées, I was out there. The French, they went crazy. VJ Day, I had gone to Frankfurt, Germany, so I wasn't in Paris on VJ Day, but I was on VE Day. They had quite a celebration.
VJ Day probably didn't mean very much in Germany, did it?
Not a whole lot. It meant a lot to the soldiers.
Yeah.
They were happy because after VE Day, most of the soldiers were sitting around over there waiting to go to Japan.
Afraid that they were going to go to Japan.
Afraid they were going to go to Japan.
Yeah.
Now, I didn't have enough points. You had Army points so much. I was overseas 2 years. But it's very battle star, you got so many points. Well, I had one battle star. Anyway, I didn't have enough points, so I was in the Army of Occupation. So the war was over, so August 20th, 1945. I didn't get home until April 46, so I was over there
did you get, you know, we read today about all these congressmen who take all these junkets at taxpayers' expense and all. Were there very many congressmen who repeatedly came back to France?
Yes, we had a lot of congressmen. We had a lot of representatives and senators.
Anybody whose name we might recognize?
I really don't. I do remember this. After the war, while I was in Wiesbaden, the Nuremberg trials were on. Now, I only had 3 years of college, but I was interested in law. So I wanted to go to those Nuremberg trials real fast. So I made an application for a 7-day pass to go to Nuremberg. And it was granted. They gave me an army jeep. I drove the jeep to Nuremberg. And I had a seat in where they had the trial. And I just came across something the other day, some old army things I was looking at. And I had drawn a picture of the courtroom. Now, Jackson, who was one of our Supreme Court justices, was a prosecutor in the United States. And I had his name sitting at the table. And then I had all the defendants. I had Goering, Goebbels. I had them all where they were sitting.
Is that right?
But that was quite a thrill to see that. And I stayed there 7 days.
Did you know then that you eventually wanted to be a judge?
No, I thought I wanted to be a lawyer. I knew that I wanted to be a lawyer. I never thought about being a judge. Well, then I came home. Time was up. I came home on a victory ship. Arrived home Easter Sunday, 1940.
You could tell me about the victory ships. How are they different?
Yeah, what are victory ships?
Well, the victory ships, of course, were made by Kaiser. And the guy that made the Kaiser automobile.
Okay, yeah.
And he was in the steel plants, too. They made hundreds of these things. And they were fast. Did not require to be in a convoy. That was thing about it. It didn't have to be in a convoy. Now I went over on the USS Wakefield, which incidentally later burned in the Pacific. But the USS Wakefield was a merchant marine ship and had 8,000 soldiers on it. I think a victory ship coming back, we only had about 2,000. But one of the big thrills on that victory ship. The morning we arrived in New York, it came over the radio, if you want to see the Statue of Liberty, go out on board. So I hustled out. And boy, the sun was just coming up. And there was the Statue of Liberty. It's quite a thrill.
That's what
got,
it was all about, huh?
Yeah. Got home Easter Sunday. 2 days before that, I arrived in Camp Atterbury, where I was separated out of Indiana. Somehow, my father was still working. He was a conductor on the Broadway Limited. And he heard that there were some troops just arrived from Europe. Well, he knew I was about to die. And I'll be a son of a gun if he didn't find the troop train I was on in Pittsburgh. Came on the train and saw me as I was going to Atterbury from New York City.
And when he got off the train, he went right away to a phone and he called me. And he said, guess who I just saw? Well, I knew it because we were all expecting him. And I said, how did he look? And he said, huge. Because when he left, he was so painfully thin, it was embarrassing. And they fattened him up in the army.
Then I got home Easter Sunday, I think it was April 16th. We were married on June 1st, and you talk about shortages. I had to go to Columbus to buy a suit to get married. And when we first got married and lived in Columbus, there wasn't any meat. There was what, synthetic pork chops and stuff? I don't know why meat was so short. There's such a shortage of meat.
And we had to wait in line at the Big Bear. That was the name of the store in Columbus.
And of course, gasoline was still rationed. You couldn't buy a car. We didn't have a car for a couple of years. Of course, housing was terrible.
And then you went back to school.
Let me show you one thing. This patch is a famous patch. It's a shaved patch, Supreme Headquarters, Allied Expeditionary Force. Here is a flaming sword of liberation in a field of black. It's going to free that black, and then the sun's going to shine, and we're going to have blue
and
sky.
Rainbow. And
yeah. Flaming sword of liberation. That was a shaved patch. Now, after the war was over and SHAPE was disbanded, they had what they called USFAT, United States Forces in European Theater. And this was that patch. You still have the sword, but it's now blue instead of black. Mm-hmm.
And very few people have this particular patch.
No,
and once in a while, we see it in an old Army show, a movie. And we get all excited because you don't see it very often.
These bars are years of 6 months service overseas.
So 2 years.
So I had 2 years overseas.
Approximately how many men were assigned to the headquarters, to SHAPE headquarters?
I'd say probably 500.
That's at any one time, right?
Yeah.
Did you ever see Patton?
Yes. Here's my writing breeches.
Oh, I guess you did.
And now tell about the color. The yellow?
I can't imagine you getting in these.
These are. And the first parade, Memorial Day parade.
I wore them.
When we were back in Lisbon, all the soldiers wore their own army uniform. And Rich was the only one in the cavalry uniform, and he had leather high boots and the big hat, you know, like the Mounties wear, with a yellow cord on.
Now, one other thing, this is an Eisenhower jacket.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And of course, the yellow on the braid is for cavalry. See, you can always tell a soldier by what outfit it belongs to, or what branch it is, army. By the color of this.
And tell her what this is. The wounded duck?
That's a ruptured duck. That's a discharge.
That's your discharge. Now, most of them have the symbol of their outfit here, but they never made one with the sabers of the cavalry.
They made them, but they were so doggone hard to get.
Oh, is that why?
They never get it.
Oh.
After I left Fort Riley.
The weight of those things. I don't know how they stood.
So that's my issue.
That's really something. What was Eleanor Roosevelt doing? I mean, she obviously wasn't just on vacation in France. Or maybe she was.
Yeah, I think it was a sightseeing tour. The war was over.
Well, she wrote a column called My Day, you know, during that time. And so she traveled after the war different places where the soldiers were and where munition plants were disbanding, and for a long time I saved her columns, but she wrote about the different places she went, and she probably was our most traveling first lady we ever. She never in Washington. She wrote the column even when she was first lady.
We did a lot of traveling too with the war correspondents in one of the what they call the old C-47 airplane. It's a two-engine Dakota or C-47, and we would go up to the front lines. It's hard when you go in that.
What you do for recreation? Anything, since you were in Paris and some of the livelier cities, anything in particular stand out in your mind?
What about your family? Our family, what do they did for you.
Well, we had basketball. I played basketball. Yeah, we had basketball.
So they had a team, you know.
And I met this Paris, this family in Paris. I went to church one Sunday, didn't I?
No, as I recall.
That's what I thought, but she says no.
You told me the original story.
Oh, well.
that in your office, the mail came in through your desk, and there were oftentimes invitations from
the family.
Yeah,
that's right, but I thought
and
it was
you opened this one, and it was from Grandpa Parison, inviting three soldiers to their home for Christmas. Dinner or something, and so you thought, boy, this, instead of putting it up on the bulletin board, Rich stuck it in his pocket. He thought, this sounds like a pretty good deal, and it was written in English, and that appealed to him.
Sure.
There were two other soldiers went with me. We worked in shape, and this guy, a wonderful fellow, was an architect and built churches there. We went to their home and they had two daughters. One was old, Nicole, and
about a year
old. And then they had one about Martine.
About 4 years younger.
And
they were very cultured family.
Very cultured. And we got to know them. And and that friendship continued. We wrote letters when I came back, and Anne kept up the correspondence.
They named Vicky. He went to the oldest girl's wedding. He was still in.
Yeah, the oldest girl. I was still over there. She got married. Her husband was in the French underground. He had just been released. So she got married. I went to her wedding.
And she had the three boys that went out to this family. Their names were all Richard. And so her first boy, she named Richard after the three soldiers. And during that time, I was doing the correspondence because he was too busy to write.
I had a girl, my name was
Anne. And so they named their first daughter Anne because of my writing to them. And
Mary went over the first, spent a summer, 6 weeks out of there. When she was, what, sophomore in high school?
Before she, between her freshman and sophomore year.
Then Karen went over, and then their daughter came over. Then Martine came over, twice. Martine came to...
We didn't know they were coming, but we sent the whole family an invitation to the wedding, you know, more or less to let
Mary's
them know
wedding
they care.
Or Karen?
Karen, and the day of the wedding and the night before, we get this phone call, and here's Martine and Tony have arrived in Pittsburgh.
They're going to rent a car and drive.
They were
going to
rent a car and drive in. Want to know how to get here from Pittsburgh. So, you know, it's become a real close.
Mm-hmm.
The oldest girl's husband died last year, and we went over last. She never came. We can't get her to come.
I think she will now. She gets everything settled. She's kind of settling up to his state.
Well, you heard all this. It's very boring, actually.
No. This fellow was in the French underground. Did you know many people that have been in the French underground?
Well, he's really the only one I ever knew. But that brings back the memory. When I was after the war, shortly after the war was over, I came back to Paris, probably to visit these people on a leave. And I remember so vividly of seeing down by the railroad station, seeing these French soldiers who had been prisoners, these underground people being brought back. Oh, they were really, very poorly. But I only knew one. That was
John.
John.
John, tell her what the business that John was in.
Well, he had the only, wasn't it? The only ancient document shop in Paris. And, you know, when people would die, he'd go through the estates for old documents. Mm-hmm. When we were over one time, he gave Anne one.
He said this would not mean, this wasn't old in French history, because America is so young. He didn't speak good English, his daughter does. And his wife could speak English pretty well. But anyway, he was just waiting for me to come the first time, and he ran upstairs and got me this document.
The document is
James
an
Monroe.
Application made by who?
James Monroe.
James Monroe for a passport.
To come back to
France.
Yeah.
Isn't that something?
But
1796.
Now that's
May the 30th, 1796.
And now his one son, since he died a year ago, his one son has been trained in dating documents, and they tear down these old ancient buildings over there, and they find, as you say, written history is in all the boxes, so they have to sort through and find anything of value and put a date on it. They chemically test the paper and all that.
And then they sell them.
And then they sell them and made a wealthy.
Oh, I'm sure.
Oh, they're very
this
wealthy.
This has the wax seal and everything on it. Mm-hmm. Isn't that something?
So that's my important document.
I guess. That may make you a very, very wealthy woman one of these days.
At an auction, I'll sell it. But we look back on the war, you know, now as being a wonderful experience. But believe me, those 4 or 5 years, not knowing where someone is that you love, you know, not hearing.
Well, I was fortunate in my Army career.
Yes, I guess.
I only had about 2 or 3 months.
Was your mail censored since you were attached to headquarters? Was your mail subject to the same kind of censorship?
Yeah,
that
it was all censored.
Wasn't?
The funny thing about it was we knew that he had arrived. He got word to us that he arrived in England. He landed on D-Day in England, not France. And then you start sending letters, and they cut out these little strips.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you've probably seen.
Yes,
I have. One someplace. And we never knew exactly what city or where, you know, we were all map. We always get the maps out and try to find out where they were located, but we never could figure out where he was. How long were you in that school center?
Oh, a couple of months.
Anyway, nobody knew where he was. And one day he sent me, went to a concert, and he sent me the program enclosed in a letter. And on the back of the program, down in real fine print, it said, printed by the Swindon Press. And they hadn't cut it out. So I immediately went and got a map to see where Swindon was, and I found Swindon. And they didn't censor our letters going in. So I wrote to him right away, and I said, I think we figured out where you are. Could it be Swindon, England? And then the next letter he wrote back and said, you're right. Located.
You know, it's funny because we went back there. Tom and I later went with us. We went back to Europe. We went back to Swindon, England, tried to find out where I was.
Where the school center was.
We had a heck of a time finding. Things changed so rapidly. Finally, we were going along and we saw an old guy walking along.
We asked 3 or 4 people.
They didn't know where the Americans
were. They never heard of the Americans.
Saw this old guy, and we stopped the car, and I went out and talked to him and asked him, do you remember during the war where the Americans were around here? Oh, yeah. So he showed us where they were.
Did you find it then?
Yeah. He said, well, we kept asking people. Nobody knew. They forgot they hadn't been there. And Rich says, I don't know if your town did, well, we gotta find some old codger.
Well, your dad, what was he in?
The Army Air Corps.
Well, he was in the Air Corps over Europe?
He flew B-24s. He was a flight instructor out in Independence, Kansas for part of the war. And then toward the end, he was shuffling aircraft back and forth between, you know, the United States.
Oh, was he?
Yeah.
That's right. Well, he even flies now, doesn't he?
He's quit now. He got Bill Haefeli back flying again, then he kind of gave it up. Well, of course, Bud's always, now he will fly with somebody else, but you know, my dad's diabetic.
Oh,
really? Uh-huh, has been for, oh my goodness, 15 years. And he's beginning to have more and more problems with it. And he more or less took himself out of the air.
Well, you have to take that strict physical every year.
Well, no, he was diabetic long after he was still getting approved then. You just have to find the right doctors.
Yeah, I know. But he has
so many hours in the air, and you know, he had flown so much. And he said, you know, he said, I know myself when I'm dangerous to myself and other people. So, you know, when I get that way, I will quit flying. And so he did about, I don't think he's probably flown now for 2 years as a pilot. Now he'll go with other people. He'll operate radio for them, you know, and that kind of thing. But he will not take a plane up by himself. You know, he's dangerous.
Would you like a glass of iced tea or something?
That would be wonderful. Thank you.
I don't know why I never even thought of it.
I want to flip this. What impressions do you have, or, you know, what did you think of Eisenhower and Churchill and some of those people that you had the opportunity to at least watch almost on a daily basis?
Well, I was very impressed with the higher-ups in the Army headquarters, right? They were all very capable men. Eisenhower was not only capable, but he was a very kind. All the other high officers that I had any contact with, I thought we had a very fine organization.
I've read a lot about the conflicts between Montgomery and Eisenhower. Did you ever see Montgomery?
Yes, I see Montgomery. I saw Montgomery. Montgomery would come to Shakes at Premier Quarters on various occasions. I never had any contact other than to see him. There was a lot of conflict.
I was going to say, were those of you in headquarters aware
at the time of the conflict? Yes, at the time we were.
Were you? And obviously you were back to Eisenhower.
Oh, yeah. of course, one other time I remember the Battle of the Bulge. Battle of the Bulge was in December of 1944. And I was in Paris in December 1944. And our standard arms, even when we were in we're building a hotel, was a, what they call the grease gun. It was an automatic gun about that long. It shot about 16, 32 caliber bullets. And when they had the Battle of the Bulge, of course there were a lot of rumors that they were dropping parachutes dressed in American uniforms on Paris, trying to get to the Supreme Headquarters. So we were all alerted, and we had to get out our weapons, have them at the ready in case anything like that happened. Nothing ever happened. It's kind of funny though, I had a very good friend, my college roommate in Capitol, was in the Army, and he ended up in the infantry division. At the Battle of the Bulge. Mm-hmm. and he was captured. And all the, somehow we got all the reports of captured people and those who were released. Well, after the war, it came through and I saw he was on a list that he had been released from some stalag in Germany. And they were all bringing him into Paris and
putting him in a hospital.
And I saw his name on that list. With all the connections I had, and I had quite a few that have been in it, I found him. And we spent, 3 days in Paris together.
That was quite a thrill.
He turned out to be the general counsel of the nation. Then he went on to law school, as I did at Ohio State.
He was an actuary in our wedding.
Yeah. He turned out to be the general counsel of the nation. Which is a pretty high job.
How bad was life in the German KW camps?
Well, I talked to John about that. The food was very scarce.
Well, it was scarce for German citizens in general by
the end
of
the
war.
They did not feed the prisoners very well. But I think overall the Germans were humane to the prisoners. Have you ever heard John complain about
anything? No, and he said that, people in the farm area around there would try to help the prisoners.
They'd try to get them free.
They would be working in the fields and they'd work their way up to the fence where the prisoners were working, and they would have some sign and they'd go over to the fence. They would give them egg, or they would give them a bread or something, and slip. And the German people around this prison camp would slip food in any way they could, because they knew that the boys were.
Of course, you heard about Malmedy and all that, where the Germans killed some American prisoners. We did the same thing.
So. Mm-hmm. So obviously, a lot of these Germans were not Nazi sympathizers at all.
No, there were a lot of them.
But they just had no.
Of course, they taught us in the army, quite frankly. The only good German was a dead German. That's what they taught us in the army. I think the Japanese were much worse. My brother was 6 years in Pacific.
Well, it's obvious that we were probably more frightened of the Japanese than we were the Germans here in this country.
Yes. For many of us, it's much German background anyway to begin with.
Especially around this area.
Yeah.
See, I had two brothers. Mm-hmm. I was the youngest. My oldest brother had rheumatic fever when he was a child, so he was 4F. And he later, he was in education. Had a doctor's degree in education.
He was principal at Mansfield Malabar High School before he.
And my other brother then was one of the first draftees, one of the first numbers.
He was the unlucky kid of the Kennedy family.
He went into service just after 18, and he was in there, 5 or 6 years. Well, their train, when it came back from the Pacific, it had a big sign on their train. Follow Mac and you'll never get back.
they threw the numbers out of the draft. Mm-hmm.
Now, there's a guy I didn't ever get to see.
It's MacArthur.
And the very first draft in Alliance, his number was in the first 20 numbers drawn. He's just a little fella. Really, he's that, he isn't any taller than I am, is he? And they've always kind of, the other two brothers, the big fellas, they always kind of babied Bud. But here, he was the one that had to go right off. Your mother never was the same. 6 years.
He had two sons in the service. That was kind of tough.
Mm-hmm. Well, especially if you had one in the Pacific. But
yeah, that would really work.
And there were quite a few. We had a National Guard division up there called the 37th Division. It was stationed in Hawaii. And almost all of those boys went with this first outfit that were drafted. So this 37th Division, we kept hearing this one was killed. That one was
killed.
Well,
that was in Ohio, 37.
Yeah. And the Alliance was really hard hit because so many of them went.
Well, you were an only child, weren't you?
No.
I have a sister who is 40 years old. She must be what? Mary's age?
Mary's 38.
Okay.
They were fairly close. I know they were in school at the same time.
What was her name?
Sue.
Oh, sure.
Susie.
I get away from her.
Yeah.
Where is she?
Blonde.
She's here in Lisbon.